The Asian American community is one of the most diverse in the country. In 2023, there were nearly 25 million Asian Americans in the United States, making up about 7% of the population. And that number is up, with Asians being the fastest growing racial and ethnic demographic in the country. But within that, the histories, the lives, the cultures, they stretch across generations and across borders. This is What We Brought, a limited series from Illinois Public Media about the Asian American experience in Central Illinois, told through stories of resilience, adaptation, and identity. I'm your host, Neethi Shastri. In this series, we're diving into the stories about what we carry with us, whether it's memories, food, language, or even the echoes of trauma. You'll hear from Asian American voices of at least 7 different cultures and diasporas, each now calling Central Illinois their home. They'll share their stories, the journeys they took, the things they left behind, and, of course, what they brought with them. Today, we're sitting down with Professor Emeritus Dr. Po Sheik Fu, a historian and writer. Before retiring, Dr. Po Sheik was a professor of Asian American Studies and of History, both of which he taught at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. A majority of his research is inspired by his time growing up in Hong Kong when it was a British colony. His published research focuses on the cultural Cold War that took place between China, Taiwan, and the United States, and the role propaganda through cinema played. Before we get more into Dr. Po Sheik's life, we need to set a historical framework for what's going on in the region during his younger years. He told us a little bit more about the history and the split between mainland China, Taiwan, and Hong Kong, and the role that the United States has played with all of them.
So mainland China is China for a long time here. Beijing, the capital. Now the second largest economy of the world, and we know that right now. It was under the Chinese Communist Party's rule since 1949. And then during the last dynasty, it was from 1644 to 1911. So the Manchu Qing dynasty, it was itself a minority in China. So under it, towards the end of the Qing dynasty, China was very weak, while the West becomes stronger because of the Industrial Revolution and all the modernization. So China lost a series of war to the West, which led to cutting Hong Kong to the British. So, and the Hong Kong become British colony that the British use it to store opiums to send into China. They start the Opium War. And 1840 was the time that the Chinese began to migrate to U.S. to work as laborers. And then the Taiwan was a different thing. It was part of China for a long time ago, and it was under the Dutch and then Portuguese rule for a long time. And then Japan occupied Taiwan from 1895 and 6 after China lost to Japan in one war. But then in 1945, after the Second World War, China take back Taiwan. And in 1949, after the Civil War between the communist and the nationalist controlled China from 1920s to 1949, the nationalist government fled to Taiwan with U.S. support. That began the whole things about the U.S.-China Cold War of whether Taiwan should go to China or part of China or what. So it now becomes a very, very complicated and extremely sensitive and controversial. Was Taiwan not part of China? Independent. And it became even more so after Hong Kong returned to China in 1997. That was already a huge thing.
After high school, Dr. Po Sheikh left the region to attend university in Toronto. He returned to Hong Kong in the 70s to practice journalism and teaching. And that's where our story begins.
The first job that I got was Colgate. I still remember in December. And also, that was in 1989. I think, as you know, it was in China, there was the Tiananmen incident. So all these things come together. I think that, well, I should take this job. As my advisor said, you should take this job. And then I talked to my family. They said, well, whatever you want to do with the PhD. And then I married at the same time too. So I just took the job. And then stayed there, got tenure at Colgate. And then I also get a job here. And then I come here to Illinois. So it's nothing conscious or intended. So it could maybe call an accidental immigrant. Should I call that? And I think probably some people are like that, like me. I mean, because of job, because they want to study and things like that.
Yeah, that was going to be kind of my next question is like, do you feel like other immigrants, even today from Hong Kong, China, anywhere in Asia, are also accidental immigrants and they have that desire to go back home? And do you also feel like maybe your family, do you feel you almost left them behind in some ways? Do you ever feel sad or like they didn't understand all these things you were doing and you know, you love them, but you have to kind of be far away?
Yeah, this is a very good question. I think especially immigrants in the 1970s, 1980s, especially felt this kind of pain or anxiety because we do leave our family behind and always feel guilty that on the one hand, we so appreciate their support. And especially financially, we could not do much. As a student, we have a very small stipend. I do remember I sent part of my stipend home for a little while, but later on, just not enough. But they just want. So it is always feel very bad. When I went to college in the 1970s in Toronto, I never returned home for 5 years. That's unlike today. I mean, as you know, I mean, today we have all these kind of internet, also convenient. But in those days, even in the 80s, it is almost impossible to make phone calls. You have to go to very far away, and then to, Stanford, I have to go to San Francisco, and to Toronto, you need to go to a particular place to make phone calls. It all depends on mails, and this is very, sometimes not very easy to get. So always feel guilty, but at the same time, also feel lucky to have the kind of support to do what I want to do. But, you know, when I find it hard to write my dissertation, then I feel even more guilty because it's so hard to write. But it is also different after in the 90s and 80s and now. I think now probably less accidental immigrants than before in China or Hong Kong because of the big political changes in Hong Kong and in China. And of course, there are other countries, there are other people who would think that US is great, they should come to US to get a great degree and then things. But for me to come to do a humanity doesn't mean that it's many things. I just come to pursue my own interests.
It's a feeling many immigrants know all too well, the ache of distance and the guilt of opportunity. As Dr. Po Sheikh has told us, for many who came in the 1970s and 80s, it wasn't just a physical journey across oceans, but also an emotional one, marked by long silences, rare phone calls, and handwritten letters. But history, as always, has a way of shifting under our feet. By the late 80s and into the 90s, waves of migration from Asia surged again, this time under different circumstances. Political challenges, economic ambition, and new global connections meant fewer accidental immigrants and more deliberate planners. Still, even as the reasons evolved, the journey often remained complicated.
being an activist in a country that you're not a citizen of. Did you face any sort of problems or racism or anything that came out of the work that you were doing?
I would say that when I was in Canada, in Toronto, I was not have enough knowledge to judge. And the second thing is that there were not that many Chinese people in Toronto. And then people in Toronto Textile Union, in the library union that I'm getting involved in, I did not feel that kind of thing from them, except that they want us to help them mobilize and to get as many new Chinese immigrants to Toronto to get involved with them as possible. As far as I can remember, they're very kind, very nice and things. And then when I came to the U.S., and I think U.S. and Canada are different. I remember that actually when I was in Toronto, people always say that you Chinese, you are Chinese. And then so I began to become aware of that identity. In Toronto, when I went, the first history course I took was someone, probably he looked very British-like, remind me of all those colonists in Hong Kong, who just mentioned that they have to be colonists because they need to be helped by the British. So that made me very upset for the first time that I really, really felt that, because I felt really offended from Hong Kong listening to those things. And of course, I mean, in Hong Kong, I did not hear things like that, you know. So that was, but he did not say it to me in person, just to the whole class, a big class. But that is one of the reasons why I later on so want to go back to Hong Kong after Prince College. But when I came to US, yes, right away, US, I think different from Canada. When I was at Stanford, I remember that I was at a canteen or something like that. I remember that near the office. And then a esteemed faculty said something to me to the effect that we would not do things like that, to make me feel very, really, really upset. So I mean, what he meant was simply that what I did, I just sat there doing nothing much, you know. I mean, he just said there's nothing. Also, we heard a lot of people, I mean, saying that China was very poor country, you know, things like that, you know, and many things like that. So they make me feel very uncomfortable. But that was true. The 1980s was the beginning of Chinese immigrants from mainland China to US. So it was one of the transition time. You know, the 1960s began to have allowed immigration from Hong Kong and Taiwan. And 1977, just right before the normalizations of the US-China relation. So I heard a lot of different kind of very biased and racist things about being Chinese, much more than in Canada, I would say.
To be identified as Chinese in North America has always carried weight. Sometimes that weight is subtle, a sense of not fully belonging. Other times it's undeniable, shaped by policies, surveillance, and suspicion. As Dr. Poshek mentioned, the 1960s and 70s saw an allowance of Chinese immigrants in the United States. But nearly a century earlier, the U.S. enacted its first major immigration restriction based explicitly on race, the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. This act barred Chinese laborers from entering the country and laid the groundwork for decades of racialized immigration policy. It followed years and years of Chinese labor, work that helped build the transcontinental railroads and contributed to a rising American economy, but was met with fear, resentment, and exclusion. This legacy of exclusion never fully disappeared. Instead, it evolved, shaped by wars, alliances, and anxieties about who belongs and who doesn't.
And later on, it was repealed after the Second World War, when China and US were allies. But then after the Civil War, when the Nationalist government fled to Taiwan and the communists conquered the mainland, the Cold War in Asia started. And in fact, actually, that is the subject of my new book, just come out last year on the Asia's Cold War. So one of the big impact was in the US, the Chinese. Many of the Chinese students who came to US to study during the Chinese Civil War time could not go back. They were stranded. And secondly, even more so, there was, just like today, a crackdown on Chinese migration, on Chinese immigrants here. And just like in the 40s, when China and the US were allies in the war against Japan and Germany, the Chinese were called good immigrants, good Americans. And now, when China was become communist, the biggest enemy of the US in Asia, Chinese become the enemy. So there are two things. Many old Chinatown establishments began to build much stronger relations with the Taiwan government. And then to try to say that we are not communist. We were the strongest anti-communist ally of the US. But at the same time, there were also suspicions of Chinese. So at that time, a lot of Chinese immigrants were using kind of dubious migrant papers. So, and then they big crackdown on those, and they could check people anywhere. If they don't have any certificate, they might be sent, they might deport. So there's many similar things, like today what they call. In some way, similar to the early 50s, where many of the Chinese were seen as communist or as spies or many things like that. And then there also the crackdown on immigration. Now, especially those Chinese scholars, scientists, or students who were in STEM subjects were under strong suspicions as being spies. And it started in the first term of President Trump. And so now, there being a lot of students and especially scholars were worried. And especially, as you know, that there are a lot of people called the OPT. That means that, you know, after you finish undergrad or finish graduate school, you can have 1 or 2 years to work and then either later on to let into to job experience for them to go back home or job experience to look for jobs to get migration in the US. So now it's all seem to be unclear. And also many scientists were worried about whether their research could be considered suspicious. So we also worried that too, you know, I think Chinese students and Chinese scholars, I mean, whatever, they did bring to Champaign-Urbana more diversity, more vibrant economy. Now I know that U of I has just stopped all the agreements with Chinese institutions. Yeah, students can apply to here, but there's no more cooperations, just like many other schools in around the country, with Chinese institutions. So now with all this crackdown of immigration and this calling Chinese suspicions, that would be another thing to be worried about. Yeah.
So where do we go from here? There's, as you mentioned, there's visa revocations. I think people sometimes fail in America to realize, like, governments are different than the people, right? The people who come, the people are just trying to survive. Yeah. And for Chinese Americans or anybody from the Chinese diaspora, like, there's a broad range. You have undocumented Chinese Americans, undocumented Taiwanese Americans. You have people who are in the middle who are on like temporary visas who could lose those visas. And you have permanent residents, you have citizens, and they all are Chinese, right? So now how do we move forward as a community? And how do we prevent repetition of the past if these surveillance tactics are being used, if the community is getting this negative rhetoric of being communist or being bad or good or whatever the case, like how do Chinese people bounce back in America and continue to survive here?
Yeah. Well, I think in a way, I mean, as a historian, I should be optimistic and just look back in the 50s. I mean, there was the crackdown was very violent in the 50s, but then almost like a flip-flop, it changed. It wants people here. I think now, in fact, that is one thing the most Chinese or Asian Americans in general, I think, probably Chinese more especially, the term called what? The perpetual foreignness, right? And they all assume you're all Chinese from there. I think they don't know that you're Chinese American or they're there. I mean, just like the good example, even a US-born Hawaiian senator, you know that, right? I mean, he was in Hawaii for many generations. And then when people saw him in the Senate, they said, oh, your English is so good. Where are you from? So that is same thing here. I don't think people know or aware that China, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and people in Chinese people know that too. There were so many different people within China. But here, they just saw that all Chinese. And no, they don't know about the Chinese Americans. So that is one, the first thing is really, really need to work on. How to get people more aware. More than half of Americans cannot name a famous Asian Americans or Chinese American. And the only two people they could mention, Jackie Chan, about 9% people. I taught a class in Hong Kong cinema. When I went to class, who do you know? The only person who say Jackie Chan. That's all, Jackie Chan. But Jackie Chan is not a Chinese American. He's a Hong Kong Chinese. And the second chance that you say that is the model minority. Actually, Chinese are overrepresented on the two extremes. It could be very rich middle class and a lot of faculties in U of I, so that in humanities, we are unrepresented, but we don't get much support resources because we are supposed to be overrepresented. But also, they were overrepresented in mental problems. The poorest also is Asian Americans and Chinese, working the busboy, dishwashers, and sweatshops in Chinatown. No one pay attention to them. So I think right now you say it's how to change it, what's move ahead. The most important is probably just to educate people that are different. You know, I have a very good colleague at U of I. He is a liberal, supports all kind of union, the GEO and all the things, very liberal and things like that, very proud liberal. But then he complained to me a couple times, why Uni High have so many foreign students? But they're not foreign students. They were American citizens. Now, even a liberal like that, very progressive and very, very kind person, would have this kind of unconscious assumption. We're all the same. Not even to say that Chinese, Taiwan thing, but just say that all Chinese are foreigners. That's why we say we stand out, are different, but at the same time, invisible in many ways.
Looking back through time, there has been an almost constant cycle of barriers and resilience. It seems that today, with the current administration dismantling systems like DEI and facilitating mass waves of deportation, that we have once again found ourselves against a wall of barriers. This led me to think, what options do Asian Americans have today to stay resilient and build resistance? Dr. Poshake had a few answers.
Well, maybe it sounds like a cliche. I just say that as a historian. Look, I hope that is not something go back to the 19th century. It's tough to go through those periods in the early 50s, late 40s. But when I go to mid-50s, the policy flip-flop. We just keep this belief, keep this hope, keep these things alive. It will change. I think now more and more the younger generations. I have two of my former students now in Chicago working in this, mobilizing the Chinese workers. So they are more now. But I just want to say that the most important thing is that just to go back to the past. I know that the past is not completely repeated, but it just helps us to keep this hope alive. It is possible and it is still working. In the 50s, in the crackdowns at that time, many of the activist groups were closed, were suppressed. But then in the 60s, many of them sprang up, and then including those to beginning to create the whole Asian American movement. So maybe a bit abstract, a bit cliched, but I think that we can say at this point.
Q keeping hope alive in a time that's extremely difficult for Chinese Americans and for Asian Americans as a whole is advice that maybe we all need to hear. Dr. Po Sheik is an author, historian, and a professor emeritus at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. You can find his many books on Amazon or at your local bookstore. Thanks for listening to What We Brought, a limited series from Illinois Public Media. I'm Neely Shastri. Our producers are myself, Arielle Ravenay, and Kulsum Khan. This podcast's editor is Arjun Tucker. Reginald Hardwick is Illinois Public Media's news director. Our cover art was designed by me, Neely Shastri, with help from Troy McDonald and Kulsum Khan. Distribution assistance also comes from Troy McDonald. You'll find this episode and more online at will.illinois.edu or wherever you get your podcasts.